begin by thanking all the organizers for a terrific conference, and especially Felix for inviting me to participate in this panel. I was a little surprised to be invited because I don't work on rhetoric, tropes, styles. I see myself pretty much as a bread and butter economic anthropologist, so that's the terrain I want to come onto in a moment. I'm not sure I can comment on the end of negotiations to respond to the main theme of the conveners, but I'll do my best. Let me start with the word. Populism is one of those slippery words that I have a lot of trouble with. I would say for half of my working week, I think it's an acceptable shorthand for a cluster of phenomena that we urgently need to investigate. But in the other half, I reject it altogether because it is applied so loosely, often just as a pejorative, derogatory, as Felix said. As anthropologists, we ought to do better than cheap put-downs and pay attention to what the people we label populists are actually saying about themselves. Seems to me elementary. In the Hungary case that I'll come onto in a moment, there is a term for populist, and it has quite a distinguished history on the left of the political spectrum as well as the right. But that's missed out when we come in heavily and label populists. So, on Mondays and Tuesdays, I take populism seriously. Thursdays and Fridays, I reject it. Today is Wednesday, and we're getting close to midday, so my schizophrenia is at its peak. After Felix's persuasive introduction, let me tell you who I am. Some of you don't know me at all. I live in Halle and have done for 20 years. I spend about 40 weeks a year in a typical year in this medium-sized city in Sachsen-Anhalt. In Sachsen-Anhalt, roughly one in four voters choose the AfD. The rest of the year, I divide primarily between the small town where I grew up in southeast Wales, visiting my father. This constituency is over 60% pro-Brexit. And when I'm not in Wales or in Halle, I'm doing my anthropology in a region of provincial Hungary, which lines up pretty solidly behind Viktor Orban's Fidesz party and other right-wing parties that get labeled populist. So these are the three contexts that I have in mind when I receive an invitation to talk about this phenomenon. And the first point I want to make is that all three of them have experienced massive socio-economic transformations in the last half century. And I just think that's fundamental background for understanding the political phenomena we see in these places nowadays. I'm not an economic determinist who claims that neoliberal political economy can explain everything. Of course, it can't. It can't explain the variety between the post-socialist cases and the particular case of post-Thatcherite, post-coal South Wales. These are different cases, but I do think there are some common structural factors that anthropologists can't ignore, even when they are placing more attention on the rhetoric, on the communication. It's not simplistic, deterministic. Many of the populists that we see out there are not the most economically dispossessed. I'm aware of these complications. But as a background, I don't think we can ignore these economic factors. And just a brief word about the Hungarian context. Post-socialist Hungary is nowadays an economic colony of this country. That seems to me pretty obvious. You only have to look at the car industry to see it. The case most flagrantly, but it's not just Hungary. The German car industry has invested in similar ways in Poland. The Visegrad countries are often grouped together for good structural reasons, but the basic pattern is not so different from when BMW and Volkswagen invest in post-socialist Eastern Germany. These were places where you could organize your labor force more cheaply, more efficiently, with less worries about strike action, Leiharbeit in East Germany. Most of you here, I think, will appreciate the comparison that I'm making. We have a few projects at the Max Planck Institute at the moment on the East German case, which I'm not going to say more about, but capitalist political economy is the starting line. So my second point, even within the Visegrad countries, there is variety. Hungary is not quite the same as next door Slovakia, although they both have neo-colonial car plants, which bring their profits back to Germany. There are similarities, but of course there are differences. So the next step is to look a little more closely. and cooperate perhaps with historians, with area studies specialists to understand why do we hear so much about the political temperature in Hungary these days, whereas Slovakia seems to be taking a more liberal turn recently. This variation, I have very little time to go into details, but I would just point out some of the special features of the Hungarian case, the fact that they can draw on symbolic resources going way back to a history of nomadic pastoralism, to coming to the Carpathian Basin with a different language, to having shamanic traditions, that their leader, even while he is reminding many audiences in the West that Hungary is defending Christian civilization for the rest of the continent, when he is visiting Moscow, or talking to the alliance of Turkic-speaking nations in Central Asia, or even when he's in Beijing, Viktor Orban can also draw on some quite distinctive symbols from Hungarian prehistory. Of course, the Christian civilizational element is more prominent. Most of Hungary was occupied by the Ottoman Turks, so this is not totally without foundation when he draws on Hungarian national traditions to support his Islamophobia. When the Ottomans were pushed back, Hungary became effectively a colony of the Habsburgs. But then there was an extraordinary half century. I mean, from 1867 onwards, the Hungarians tried hard and failed to get their independence in 1848. Absolute power was restored, but then, almost by magic, there was a compromise, and Hungary shared in the running of a quite extraordinary empire in Central Europe. It was the junior partner. Budapest was never quite the equivalent of Vienna, but the Hungarians built up an imperial tradition in that period. And then they lost it all completely. Almost exactly 100 years ago, it will be very interesting to see how the Hungarians commemorate the treaty signed at Trianon in June 1920, when their historic kingdom was truncated, mutilated, as the Hungarian metaphor has it. Hungary experienced trauma 100 years ago, and that is very definitely one of the elements fueling political communication in that country down to the present day. The Trianon Agreement at the end of the First World War was condemned by all sides of the political spectrum, by the left wing, by the communists, as well as by the nationalists of that era. Jumping on to the socialist era, you cannot ignore the particular features of Hungarian socialism if you want to understand where that country is today. Hungary had one of the more successful experiments with a kind of market socialism, at least after 1968, very decentralized, very consumer-oriented, and many people, in particular in the provinces, in villages such as the one I studied in the 1970s for my doctoral project, they did pretty well in the last socialist decades. In other words, when you look at where they are now, they have fallen further. Their experience of post-socialist transformation has been a more dramatic one than that of most of their East Bloc neighbors, where the transition, it's negative almost wherever you look, but it's particularly negative for people who are on an upward trajectory at the end of socialism. So those are the things you need to bear in mind. And so far, what have I done? I've tried to talk a little bit about political economy, talk a little bit about history, and you may be wondering where the anthropology is going to come in, because so far what I've said could probably be said much better by many other kinds of social scientists, or by historians, or the area studies scholars. And this is a challenge, I think, to us all. If we think about theory, I am not yet convinced that we have any distinctive anthropological approaches. Theory, just a very quick word. I think respect, first of all, for scholars in the German-speaking world with something to say. Vienna's André Gingrich was a pioneer in getting anthropologists to look seriously at what he calls neo-nationalism. I don't think he uses populism, not very often. I would point to the work of Jonathan Friedman and Don Kalb as making significant contributions. They would say from within our discipline, but I think for many of you here, that would be too close to a Marxist political economy, world systems perspective, not really anthropology. Again, in the German-speaking world, I have a lot of respect for the work of the late Georg Elwert, For Gunter Schlee's work on identity, I wonder if those models of we groups and identity switching might be adapted to the terrain of populist politics, but I haven't seen it done yet. I'm not sure, at the moment at least, that anthropology has something new to bring to the table in terms of theory. So quickly then, what do we have? We have ethnography. So we're back to anthropology defining itself by its method. We do have rich ethnographic studies coming along. Some have been presented at this conference. In a sense, that's what I'm trying to do with my ongoing work in Hungary. So in the few minutes that I have left, I want to take you now to a place in southern Hungary, close to the Serbian border, where I've been working since the 1970s. This was a rather splendid wedding to which I was invited on the 31st of August. I'm afraid I got there a bit too late in the day to have the energy for a wedding party. But the young man who you can see kneeling on the right is a labor migrant. He actually lives in Coventry and has done for the last 9 years. That's a small town in the Midlands, England. His wife, as she now is, she has a rather good job in Coventry, working for a large enterprise as its human resources manager. He has a degree from Hungary, but he's been working as a manual worker since going to England. He now supervises other manual workers, but he's obviously not followed up on the career that he was trained for. He comes from the small village that I've known since the 1970s. Just perhaps in parenthesis here, the consequences for British young people when foreigners, such as the two I just showed you, who were legalizing their relationship, the word for living together in Hungarian, they have the lovely phrase, a wild marriage. And they invited people like me and many others to go to their wedding as the domestication of their wild marriage. That's what they did on the 31st of August. They also invited the bride's father, as you might imagine, but he wasn't able to attend. He runs a quite successful company in the provincial capital. It's called Kecskemét. It's also the scene of one of the largest car factories in Hungary, the Mercedes-Benz complex. The bride's father has a family business which was attractive to one of Viktor Orban's friends, a guy he went to school with, currently thought to be the richest person in Hungary, who suggested that the bride's father might be interested in selling her company for the symbolic sum of one forint. And when the offer was rejected, this was an offer you can't refuse in the classical mafia style. When the offer was rejected, the bride's father was quickly taken into custody and therefore missed his daughter's wedding. That's the way things work in Hungary at the moment. I couldn't check that story, obviously, but the story is given credence when it's told to me in the villages, in the small towns. This is happening all the time. This is how Hungary is forming a national bourgeoisie. There are even some intellectuals in the Fidesz party who try to justify this on the grounds that, after all, this is how the national bourgeoisie was formed in North America in the 19th century and elsewhere in Western Europe in past generations. So what's special about the Hungarian case? Here we have the same family, two more brothers from that family in their village. They've both moved away from the parental home, but they come back quite regularly to help their aging parents look after the animals. Up to a dozen cattle and quite a lot of pigs in this village home, backyard, and the young man on the right is actually my godson. So I'm giving you some real intimate insights here into my spiritual kinship in this village. He still lives in the village, but on an isolated farm where he's trying very hard to establish his own farming business. But so far, the right opportunities haven't come along. He's desperate for Brussels to offer some opportunities to young men like himself to plant some vineyards and start making an independent entrepreneurial career. Here are the parents coming up. The man on the right is my oldest friend in the village. He picked me up in his Trabant when I was hitchhiking around looking for a village back in the 1970s. And we've been good friends ever since. He was the ideal partner for me at the time because he was the agronomist with special responsibilities for small farming, household farming, and that's what I was working on for my PhD. So we've been friends for over 40 years. His wife is considerably younger. No time for the details. But here you see the expanded set. Yes, I'm the anthropologist there, taken a couple of weeks ago. This is a Sunday, so we're all wearing our best clothes. It's a Sunday afternoon. The lady on the left, why has she gone? The lady on the left, thank you, is the person I'd like you to focus on for a moment. She's the youngest child. She's their only daughter. She is studying at the University of Szeged. She cares about public life. She's inherited something from her father, the sense that people like her family and her community are being screwed by institutions out there somewhere. Her father has this basic moral commitment. He hasn't changed his political colors, as many in Hungary did after the end of communism. He is probably the only man in the village who still votes for the successor to the Communist Party. But she is a member of Jobbik, which is even further to the right than Viktor Orban's Fidesz party. It's a little bit complicated in recent years, but still, you can think of Jobbik as an archetypal populist party privileging the nation. That's the only moral basis we have in our present situation. That's the kind of rhetoric they spout. They object to the German colonization. They think Brussels is as corrupt as Budapest is corrupt, the ministries in the capital, and we need to get back to something pure and Hungarian. This is what the daughter stands for. And she's just about converted her mother to her position. She hasn't converted her father. They just don't talk about politics anymore. But this is what I see going on in very intimate contexts in the families that I know best in Hungary. So I need to come to a conclusion at this point, and I hope there is one more slide. Yes. So my conclusions, want to say something about politics, I suppose, and outreach. Germans in the room will understand the metaphor of finger wagging, which we have in English as well. I hope Germans can appreciate why, when it is reported in Hungary, what the liberal press, and I think this should be non-controversial, at least from a Hungarian perspective, the major media outlets, the television channels that most people watch, the newspapers that most people read, there is what Hungarians see as a liberal bias, which is always trying hard to put them down. And they think it's terribly ironic that Mrs. Merkel could get the moral high ground through taking the stand that she took in 2015, when after all, Hungarians were at that time trying to enforce what most people in Hungary, even opposition parties, took to be something like rule of law at the height of the migration crisis. So a lot of irony and a lot of, well, accusations of hypocrisy and self-serving. Remember those German car factories? Germans are not really in a position to wag their fingers at the populists in Hungary when, for doing the same work in Stuttgart, you get paid four times as much as the guys in Kecskemét. Of course, no finger wagging, but no complacency either. The last thing I would want is for you to go away thinking I am defending Viktor Orban or speaking up for the AfD. That is not my intention. Believe me, it's not my intention. But Orban, despite coming up with this term, it's his phrase, illiberalism. We are an illiberal democracy, he says. And I take that seriously. It's not liberal in the sense that we have liberal, plural party politics. Crude, coarse games are being played all the time. But I don't think you can deny it's democratic. Orban got over 50% of the vote in the European parliamentary elections a few months ago, and Kaczynski in Poland got almost as many, just under 50% in his case. So one in two voters are supporting the populists. But of course, only about half the population, less than half the population, is going to vote in the first place. So it's one in four who are actually lining up behind Viktor Orban and Jarosław Kaczynski. There is a democracy. There is, I would say, ongoing negotiation. And I didn't say much about the philosophy of anthropology that I was going to include in my final remarks, but I've only got 30 seconds now. That's what it comes down to for me at the end. Anthropologists doing work in those sectors of society where other scholars are not doing very much empirical work. I think when you do that kind of work in village and small towns in Hungary, you will end up appreciating that there is a constant debate in Hungary between the state-controlled media, where Orban's voice is omnipresent, and opposition voices, which are never actually silenced. So the demonizing which you get, the apocalyptic tones of just about every article in the Spiegel about Hungary, and he's a very good journalist, by the way, the guy who writes for the Spiegel, is one of the best. But I think the lesson I draw as an anthropologist is that we need to address the causes of Europe's current woes in political economy And then the specter of populism will eventually pass, and we won't need to put it so prominently on the program at future conferences of this association. Thank you.